Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 164. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing over there, man?
You know, I feel like we're still a ways out from VMworld, but the stress is already starting to come on that I got to get everything in. So it's starting to get to crunch time, Pete. So we're counting down the days.
I'm staring at you on this Zoom, and it's looking pretty cloudy in your office there.
Yeah, we got some of the runoff from the hurricane. There's been some lightning storms. So, but
yeah,
I think also my Zoom background is getting perpetually more interesting as days goes on. I'm already planning my next arts and crafts project to definitely cloud this office up.
Yeah, and for those that can't see, obviously, John's got a bunch of neon clouds behind him, and he's looking. He's looking pretty cloudy. I like it. John, I will say, while your background is interesting, you don't have the best looking background I can see in this Zoom call. That title would go to a gentleman by the name of Mike Roy. We're going to bring him on in just one second because his background is pretty awesome. Miles Gray, however, is also joining us. Miles, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Pete. Good to be back.
Appreciate you coming, man. And this is a good conversation. Usually when there's anything related to any DevOps hipstery stuff, I like to have Miles around because he has a pretty good opinion about these things. Today, we're talking about something called Project Nautilus. It's part of Fusion, something that has been around for a while, but is definitely looking different these days. And our expert guest today is going to be, as I mentioned earlier, Mike Roy. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Mike, first off, your background. That's not a picture. Mm-hmm. I can see it's really your office. You've got about 8 or 9 guitars, a keyboard, a drum set. You seem to be quite the musician. What do you got there?
Yeah, we've got 1, 2, I think I got about 9 guitars if you include the ukulele bass. Ukulele basses exist. Who knew? my girlfriend plays ukulele, so this is a great way for us to, you know, play together. A couple synths. I have an Access Virus off on the side there, which I'm very proud of. There's a drum set, electronic drum set over here.
What's your favorite guitar?
One that you own or one that you also don't own? One of each. How about that?
Yeah, the one that I own, I probably have to say my Jackson. So I have one of the Jackson HT6, one of the Misha Mansour. I think the color is Porsche blue.
Nice.
It's specifically Misha's Porsche blue. And the one that I don't have probably is a Strandberg Bowden. I'm probably saying the name wrong, Strandberg. But it's this headless, really, really amazing type of instrument that's, you know, there's no headstock on it. It's the neck has this crazy shape that makes it easier to play. And I'm just waiting for them to get back in stock so I can pick one up.
Sure. Nice. Looks pretty cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't play an instrument, but I do like to listen to them. So I'd love to hear what you got someday.
Yeah. Well, we do have a SoundCloud. I'll put that on there after the link. There's not much guitar on there. I do, you know, a combination of metal on the one side, you know, progressive sort of vocal-less metal, and then on the other side it's psychedelic trance type of stuff, psytrance.
Nice.
Your usual mixture of musical genres.
You know, as you do. I find it interesting though, like back in the day, everyone sort of had this very similar shared experience where there was like a few key bands and everyone loved them, and now everybody, there's so many like sub genres out there. Like it's pretty incredible that any type of interest that you have, there's a community for it and you know, a healthy repertoire of content.
Thank you, sure. Internet and Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think it has to do with the fact that there's just no money in making music anymore. And the technology to make it is so easy and accessible that anybody can make studio quality music in their, you know, in their big garage or, you know, the loft in their apartment. And it sounds just like you were at whatever studio in Los Angeles or something.
Mm-hmm. Good
Maybe
stuff.
Not quite as good, but you know.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we're not here to talk about music, unfortunately, because if we did, I think we could probably spend 5 hours just going through your inventory there. But we're talking about Fusion today. Now, this is not the Fusion of my day. John, when I first started using VMware Fusion, it was just so I could get Windows on my Mac. How about you?
Yeah, no, that was pretty much it. I was carrying a MacBook Air and I had some things, some SAN management software I had to run Windows for one reason or another. And so I used it as kind of a local. I had a couple of different Windows images I'd spin up for various purposes, but that was pretty much it. And it looks like it's really evolved beyond that, as honestly, a lot of my Windows needs have gone down. I'm instead using it for Linux and other things.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And now, obviously, you can use containers with Fusion, which is why I want to talk to you guys today. So why don't you give us the high level? What is new with Fusion these days as it pertains to containers?
Yeah, so we've embarked on this journey a couple of years ago where, you know, previously we were focused with Fusion on the switcher. So, hey, you just got a Mac and you're, you know, used to Windows apps. You have some dependencies there. Go get that Mac. We'll convert your Windows PC into a virtual machine. Way you go, right? And that's great. You know, a lot of folks were able to make that transition and go forward. But today, that use case is a little bit less prevalent. I mean, the need for Windows on the Mac is still there. But when you think about how application developers sort of build apps nowadays, it's a lot different than how they used to. So Fusion is a derivative of Workstation. And Workstation was originally called VMware 1.0 for Linux. And it was focused on developers. You needed a virtual computer that looked like your production computer. So you needed to have that in a sandbox and have that running in a way that was separate from your host. And that became, you know, what developers used and how they would build their app. They would package it as the VM, give that VM over to IT. IT goes, okay, drop that VM into the thing and they can tweak the compute settings on it or add load balancing and things like that. But
yeah,
ultimately it was, hey, ship the VM and away you go. Whereas nowadays, you know, apps are way more complicated. You know, you're talking about cloud services and all this sort of service-oriented architecture, right? Where you just have a series of services talking to each other in behind some front end and, you know, it's all APIs on the back end. And so the way that we build those type of things is it's all Linux, you know, like we have containers, we have Kubernetes, but really it's Linux, right? And I, you know, myself, I've been a Linux guy since 99 or something like that. I cut my teeth on OpenBSD and I used Gentoo for fun.
Ooh, my goodness, Gentoo.
Yeah. I ran a whole data center in Toronto.
Gentoo is the one where you compiled everything. I always imagine Gentoo users as being the kind of person who would take like a Honda Civic and then add like an obnoxious, like, you know, air intake to it and put like two spoilers on it because, you know, that's going to give it more down. It's going to make that Honda Civic faster. That was always my opinion of all the Gentoo users and their never ending compiling.
Or, you know, people that buy perfectly good guitars and then swap out all the hardware on them just because. Who would do that?
Who?
I feel personally attacked. Oh, I'm dying here.
I think that's a great step away from Arch.
It's a good characteristic. I thought it was just so fun. Be like, yeah, I'm going to build my own kernel. Emerge this. Click. I'll be back in 3 days when it's done compiling.
And meanwhile, I was a Mandrake user.
Oh, I miss Mandrake.
URPMI.
That's good. That was the one that I actually used as a daily desktop driver for a little while because it was just a lot of the stuff was easy. But yeah, so I mean, you know, back to the conversation, you know, everything's Linux. Linux on the desktop, Linux everywhere. You don't realize it, but you know, the app that you use on your phone is powered by some cloud service that's not running Windows. It's running some Linux service.
Yep.
So, you know, containers came out as a way to give that a similar type of packaging that virtual machines have, but to have a little more flexibility with that and certainly less resources required, right? You can have one host and the difference between the virtual machine and the container is that, you know, that one host is sharing the same kernel with however many containers are running on it. Whereas with a virtual machine, you have physical or what the computer operating system thinks is physical separation of the things. So, you know, the use cases are a little similar, but the way that we deploy them gets different and the way that we build them gets different. So in response to that, you know, it became very difficult to do container work on Fusion. And when you have this great workflow that you're used to and this new technology comes over and it doesn't fit that workflow, it becomes disruptive, right? So like you would have to, if you wanted to do container development, you'd have to spin up a full Linux virtual machine, go into there and then, you know, work just native Linux. And that's cool. You know, Docker for Mac came around. They made that a little easier. But the way Docker for Mac works is it, you know, originally it would throw down, you needed VirtualBox and it would throw down a big VM. It still does this today, just uses Apple's hypervisor, but it throws down a big VM. It's 3 gigs of memory. You can configure it and, you know, all the containers run inside of there. And we thought that there was a better way to do it, particularly as the way that developers work is, you know, you're going to build some container, build some service, and then you want to look at it, whether it's with your browser on your desktop or some other browser. And that's really where virtualization comes in. So you can have now the same tool, you can download a container, you can pull it, very similar syntax. You know, we use a command line called vcuttle, so vctl, vcontrol, vcuttle, let the eternal debate begin. You know,
and, come on, you're going to let that simmer versus like just lay down the law and we have a...
Everyone knows CTL. That's the end of it. Move on.
Yeah, see, vctl, vcontrol, vcuttle.
Well, I find this all interesting because previously when I think of, you know, developers who are testing stuff out, you know, you ended up with a couple things. You ended up with, you know, sometimes they would end up have a dev server that looked nothing like prod. I mean, maybe they do like have this giant, you know, cloud management platform and pipeline tooling. But there's a lot of cases where people either for connectivity reasons or something, they just want to work remote. There's, you know, there's locality there. And containers, you know, challenge, they solve some of this. But this also prevents also kind of the devs gone wild problem of these developers who would end up like building out these massive systems in their house or like under their desk. The amount of engineers I've seen who are guilty of like having an entire PowerEdge server or like a DL server sitting under their desk, like this actually solves a lot of that while keeping them still productive. It's an interesting middle ground between, I guess, a lot of the previous workflows and still trying to give something that's going to be a lot more real.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, part of it too is having that switching from tools, right? Like, okay, so you've got that dev box somewhere and you're working locally. Okay, cool. Like I'm doing my thing. Okay, now I have to like take this code that I've been hacking and somehow get it to that dev box and get it over there and then make sure it runs over there and then figure out, okay, what's different between this environment and that environment? And then what's different between that environment and my production environment? And how do I, you know, accommodate all that? And containers really help you sort of not have to worry about all that. And when you can combine virtual machines and containers, you get this really best of both worlds scenario where you have the process and resource isolation of a virtual machine, but then you still have the operational coolness and the speed of delivery of containers, right? And then when you layer Kubernetes on top of that, I mean, then everything just gets really sweet because now you don't got to deal with placement and, you know, you don't need crazy DRS rules for this or that. It's just, okay, Kubernetes is just handling it all. And now that that's all more baked into the, you know, the vSphere platform, that just makes it super easy for IT admins to get started. They don't got to go ahead and learn how the intricacies of Kubernetes and Linux over the X number of years of development works. They just know that, you know, it works in vSphere and away they go.
Well, and one thing I'll say is if you just let developers build their own like local virtual appliance and then ship that, most developers are actually not Linux experts. They're not Unix experts. They will barf logs all over the place. They won't put stuff in var log. Like they will not do basic house cleaning. In fact, you know, even here at VMware, we had have a project Photon as a standardized Linux distribution and a team on standardizing where we put logs and things like that. And, you know, you'd still have to have, you could have standardization problems in how stuff got exported, virtual hardware versions. There was still the networking stuff of, okay, we shipped it with DHCP, but do we test that? Containers simplify so much of that. It's also just a lot less data to ship around. You're no longer shipping this 10 gigabyte image that includes, you know, oftentimes the developer didn't know which libraries they'd want before containers. So you'd end up with the whole kitchen sink of unnecessary. And those are extra security holes potentially. Kind of virtual appliances were supposed to save us from Windows and simplify things, but actually they created a lot of lifecycle problems and there were a lot of third-party virtual appliances out there that frankly kind of got abandoned from a lifecycle perspective. Versus container world here, you build that container locally, you ship it to a repo, you ship it to Harbor, it feeds into the CI/CD pipeline, my testing and my other introspection runs and it goes to prod. This is just such a cleaner way and it keeps the developer from being responsible for all these things that frankly they have no business managing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would also sort of say that I would say it's like difference in a nuance between how we would do things with VMs, where you could have a VM that was running for a bajillion days, right? I mean, there used to be, you know, badges of honor you would get for the amount of uptime that your host would have, right?
Yeah.
Or that your guest would have, whatever. And containers, it's a little different, right? Like I've definitely found that in running them in my own production environments, you know, between DigitalOcean and Google Cloud and Amazon, that, you know, you actually need to sort of keep them up to date. You have to have that pipeline in place. And that creates a little bit of a complexity that's different from VMs, you know, that you could ship that VM and be like, okay, done and dusted, right? But a container, it's like, okay, like how is that pipeline still looping? Is it still happening? Is there new vulnerabilities that we need to swap out libraries to address and things like that? And, but I think the other counterpoint to that too is, if you look at Kubernetes and how you end up orchestrating these things, a lot of that stuff gets hidden and abstracted. So it's not like you have that full VM sitting out there with all those vulnerabilities. All of those services are running on containers that are behind a much more secure load balancer, a much more secure service abstraction model. So, you know, it...
I guess security is driving a lot of the... I mean, some of it's product improvement. Like we're shipping... Part of the whole point of DevOps is you can ship code more quickly, but security and just the speed at which we all have to patch now and the ability to tie into better network service, that seems to be driving a lot of this.
Well, I think the fact that it's all automated as well really takes away the fear of patching. Whereas the patching before, you went such massive amounts of time between, say, Windows patches that everyone was like, oh, if I do something here, it's going to break Windows. And, you know, you restart it and it breaks your services or your application or whatever. Now that the lifecycle and the rebuilding of containers is sort of just part of the whole thing, like it's just part of updating them because of the fact that containers are immutable. The fact that you can't change what's inside a container means you have to redeploy it and you have to perfect the art of the lifecycle of a container. And that removes a lot of the fear of doing updates.
Absolutely.
Well, Miles, I think you've unlocked something. I think I'm going to quit my job, actually. I've got a startup idea. So remember the challenge before with DRS of vMotions are happening faster than we can file change control tickets? Well, we need something that automates requesting patch windows because you have to have a big patch window to patch things. And if stuff's just flying through these pipelines all the time, I mean, we're going to need some software that automates the creation of the patch window, the approval of the patch window, and the closing of the patch window. And creating that conference bridge that we all were on at 3 a.m. for some particular reason while someone pushed some binaries that we had tested 12 times already.
But this is the beauty of that stuff is because it is so well understood, because the lifecycle is so well understood, because the pipeline is used for everything and it's the source of truth. Change control is not really a thing anymore. I mean, yeah, you still do change control whenever you do big changes, but rudimentary, you know, bug fixes and that kind of thing can just be shipped. Like if it goes through the testing pipeline and it uses continuous delivery, boom, straight out into production. If it passes all the tests, you should be good. There should be no need for cabs and all that kind of, you know, crap
so,
that we've had to go through in the past.
So I understand that fuel costs are going up, but I found another way to heat your house in the winter. We're going to burn all of the ITIL training books that in the world that exist and use those to heat everyone's home this winter because that's what this sounds like.
It's a sound strategy. I would say two miles banking on top of that is, you know, organizations, and I've read this and I think this is sort of, you know, out there, but organizations that release more frequently have less risk per release. If you're used to releasing 100 times a day, each time you release, it's not that big a deal. But if you release once every 8, 12, 16 months, the amount of stuff that's going to break and the amount of time required to address all of that each release is ridiculous.
Well, the test coverage is never complete when you're pushing that much code at once. I mean, there's always the testers ultimately always end up being the end user.
The smaller the changes, the easier it is to find the bugs. Simple as that. And it's like DR testing. The more you test it, the better you get at it. The more able you are to respond to something that goes wrong. And it's the exact same when you're shipping new code as to responding to failures in your DR system or whatever. So
yeah, and that's how we look at it. Like how the way that we characterize it in sort of the productization of what we've done is we look at two loops, you know, have your inner loop and your outer loop, right? Your inner loop where you're sort of working on all of that stuff, making your features ready, making your features work. And then, okay, I'm happy. I've been locally building it, testing it in something that looks, has some degree of fidelity with production. Okay, cool. Commit to Git, my source or whatever repo perforce. Yeah. And so then the outer loop takes over, and the outer loop is where your CI/CD pipelines are, right? So that's where you have all that vulnerability scanning, all your, you know, your change tracking and your eventual deployment to stage and production and all that. So, you know, that's where Nautilus really comes in, is it helps folks go through that inner loop without having to use like six different tools. You know, you just, you know, you vcolor run your image or you vcolor build. You can build the container from a standard Docker file. Okay, cool. The way that our implementation works is you actually, each container is deployed in a very super tiny little VM based on Photon. Mm-hmm. It's actually based on the CRX runtime that we have in what was called Project Pacific. So your vSphere.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So we actually took that code, brought it over, modified it for our use case. And so when you fire up a container, the image that it's running in is about 250 megs, give or take, of memory. In memory running. So, and then it gets its own IP address. So it's attached to the VMnet that it gets deployed on. You can tweak that VMnet add packet loss, latency, things like that. And then you can open up the VM or the IP address of the container in a browser directly. You don't need to port forward, right? So like with Docker, you do like, you know, dash P, this port, that port, you know, and then it goes. Whereas us, it just, you don't need the dash P. But if you have Pro and you enter that port forward command, it actually tells the VMnet to do the port forwarding, which means you can now share your service in that container with anybody else on your network.
And where does it get the IP from?
The VMnet.
Okay.
So it's just DHCP, you know, the same thing that the NAT service gives a VM, an IP address on Fusion. It just, you know, it's another network that gets spun up.
Nice.
So you mentioned that the vctl command, vcuddle, whatever we're going to call it. So how does that differ from, say I already use the Docker CLI, which I do, and I'm familiar with the commands there. Are we saying that the commands are basically the same? We just swap out Docker for vctl and we'll get kind of the same thing?
Essentially, but we look at it more like, you know, Docker has evolved a lot over the years and it's added a lot of stuff that not everybody uses. Some of it's pretty helpful, particularly in the data center. But for our use case of local loop, right, a local development loop, you know, we looked at basically Docker around version 1.10, 1.10. And that was sort of this point in time before everything changed and they started adding all this new functionality that didn't necessarily apply to that local loop. So we just looked at it as, okay, what matters for my local, you know, development environment, right? And my local loop, which means, you know, I need to do build, I need to create, I need to describe. You know, I probably need to exec. We added some stuff where you can actually exec into the VM container host itself. You know, I need to list my images. I need to list my running containers, push, pull, delete, start, stop, that kind of stuff. Whereas we didn't get into all the extended stuff that Docker can do that is interesting, but doesn't always apply to, like I said, that local development loop.
I saw something about it being OCI compliant. Does that mean I can swap out the backend with my chosen runtime if I don't want to use CRX and I want to use Containerd or whatever else? I could do that, or how does that work?
I don't know how you would accomplish that. I mean, the way that that Nautilus works, right, and that vcuddle works is that it is Containerd. We you know, we took Containerd, we made a fork of it. We are, you know, looking to reach out to the community and do some collaboration and some upstream contribution there. But we took Containerd, we made it run on the Mac. We added a shim layer that talks to our virtual appliance, and that's sort of how that you know, that gets tied in. But the Containerd socket itself does get exposed. So there's like a folder path. It's like root, or it's /home/vcuddle/storage/, you know, I think a few other paths, and then Containerd.sock. So that Containerd socket totally works. And what we've been doing is we've actually been experimenting on replacing the binaries in the system. So like you have Docker, we would create an alias that takes Docker and makes it vcuddle. And then we are able, in our, you know, our labs here, we actually have kind running. So you can actually run Kubernetes and Docker without Docker, doing it completely with Containerd with vcuddle. Yeah, we're really excited. We're going to be shipping that later this year. In, you know, our next major release, which is coming up. It didn't quite make it in time for tech preview.
I was just about to ask you about tech preview, because I know there have been some updates. What were some of the bigger updates in the last tech preview that you had?
Yeah, so, you know, first off, you know, container, or I should say vcuddle exists. We created it and we released it earlier, I think it was in February. And it was different then. We weren't sure exactly what the syntax that our users were going to want. We were splitting a line in between kubectl and Docker CLI. And our users kind of looked at it and gave us feedback. And we went to that Docker, you know, 1.10 sort of era UX that, you know, sort of made sense for the use case. So that was introduced. And then, like I said, in February, we introduced it first, and then we changed it when we released again in May. And so Tech Preview 2, which came out in May, introduced that. We also got, you know, cool stuff at the platform. So there's, you know, DirectX 11. We're going to be shipping that later this year. So, you know, you can play newer games and stuff. We're also adding eGPU support. So if you have like a big old external graphics card, you know, like I've got an eGPU over here with like a Radeon 5700.
It's Thunderbolt connected, right?
Yeah. And it can drive the display built into the Mac now. So you don't actually have to like plug your display into the eGPU. Ooh. You just plug the eGPU one cable into it, and then all the rendering happens on the graphics. It's not pass through, but
it's a PCI Express bus. Sorry. So yeah.
Yeah. It's 40 gigabit or whatever, right?
So if I were a masochist, I could run Windows on my Mac on Fusion, attach an eGPU to it and run Crysis on there and actually play it and not have my Mac go on fire.
I'm going to say no on Crysis. However, okay. In theory, other stuff. I've been playing Age of Empires HD in 4K, which has been fun.
Star Citizen. That's my name now.
Star Citizen.
We need another 64 gigs of RAM. We'll be fine.
Yeah, and so it's not passed through. It's not like you can give it DX12. It's still going to be DX11, and it's just our rendering process, which uses Apple's Metal. It'll do it on the beefier graphics hardware. So there's a big improvement to be had, but it's not like native. We're not quite there. But then, yeah, so, you know, those are sort of it on the Fusion side. And then recently middle, early July, we released a tech preview for Workstation, which has vCUDL in it as well. So a little while ago, we released a tech preview for Workstation, which added Hyper-V support, which means we're actually using we're using Windows hypervisor platform APIs to drive Workstation.
Oh, wow.
So when you have Hyper-V mode turned on for like WSL, or if you use Docker for Mac or Docker for Windows, it needs this. Or even if you're using, there's some security features called Device Guard and Credential Guard that turn Hyper-V mode on. So Workstation uses the Hyper-V as the hypervisor aspect of things, you know, combined with us, right? It's like a mash of the two. So we added the container support to that. So you have that same vCUDL syntax workflow support on Mac and on Windows. Yeah.
I'm going to call it vCUDL myself, if that's okay. Is vCUDL acceptable?
I mean, hey, man, Bob's your uncle. It's a very personal thing for us all.
Okay.
I noticed as well that you got Big Sur support in the new tech preview as well, which, you know, me being who I am, I have Big Sur installed on my almost 10-year-old Mac now. And
it'll let you do that.
Yeah, it's not having a good time, let me tell you. But I did install the beta and it all runs great, but there was some pretty big architectural changes behind how Big Sur lets you run VMs. Like, you can't just load kernel extensions anymore, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, where they were originally, it sounded like they were going to completely drop all kernel extensions, like third party, from this release. And it turns out they didn't. They just restricted certain types of virtualization, or certain types of kernel extensions, one of those being virtualization. So you can't run virtualization kernel extensions on Big Sur. Just won't happen. But as a result, the same work that we had to do to make Workstation support the Windows hypervisor APIs, we actually did the same thing for Fusion, right? So Fusion, Workstation, ESX, all, you know, very similar code, very, very much sharing of the how what we call the monitor, the low-level hypervisor aspects of the hypervisor work. And so adopting that to leverage Apple's APIs puts us in a position where we don't need kernel extensions. So we actually don't have the x86 kernel extension to run the VM itself. We no longer need the USB kernel extensions because we're using Apple's USB framework, as well as the networking. So we had our own networking stack before, now we're using Apple's. And it's been fun. You know, Apple's been really good to work with. Some folks might find that strange, but we've been having a really great time working together. And there's definitely some limitations and some learnings that we haven't got quite there as far as parity with the way that we did things and our maturity of our stack. So like on the networking side, for example, there's some NAT bugs and things like that we're working through. But the nice thing is, you know, like Apple's been really good to work with. And same thing with Microsoft. You know, it's kind of incredible, this type of collaboration that we've been able to achieve with what used to be, you know, something completely unheard of, that, you know, now VMware is using non-VMware hypervisor APIs to drive VMs. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah,
at the same time, I think it really speaks to this era that we're all in right now, right? Like, it's all about collaboration and how do we get through this together? And how do we solve the big problems for everybody instead of just like, how do I increase my market share? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I don't look at it like that. I mean,
I think internal developers are like, I have to use something to make this work. It's, you know, and also if everyone's listening to the customer, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to meet the customers where they're at. And that's kind of a phrase I've heard Pat and others say that very much represents the need of us all to play nice.
Yeah, I agree. You can't just show up and say, hey, come visit our sandbox. It's got all the great stuff anymore. We got to go to where they are and be a part of those workflows. And that's, you know, that's why I'm wearing a Containerd shirt right now. That's why, you know, we think that that's a really great technology to get behind. That's why we're working with Apple and working with Microsoft to try and solve some of these big problems.
I like it. So the tech preview? Is that something that folks can get their hands on? Is there a beta or is there a way that folks can try it?
Yeah. So Tech Preview is out there right now. It's free. We'll put the link in the show notes, but you can get to it from the VMware blog. I think we've had three tech previews. So there's like 20H2 and then there's like 20H2 July. So the July one has all the latest bits. Yeah, it's free. So if you want to use it, you don't have a Fusion license today or even a workstation, go ahead. The licenses are built in. And in the case of Fusion, you can actually install it alongside your existing Fusion installation. So you have different app names. And when we in the Mac, when we load up one or the other, it loads all the kernel extensions with it. So they won't conflict. So nice. When you quit the one, it'll remove all the kernel extensions. You load the other one, it loads them all up. But on the case of workstation, Windows isn't as friendly. So you can only have one.
But good, you can have them both. And if you want to install this, it doesn't break the other one, right? So they're separate. I like it.
Yeah, the only thing folks need to be concerned about is like if you upgrade a VM to the Tech Preview, you've upgraded it. And if you want it to run on the old one, you have to downgrade it again.
Sure.
So it's a good idea to make a copy of it or to use it for non-production stuff because it may break, it may be thorny. It's also got debugging hooks turned on. So we know that there's performance hits that are inherent there just because we're doing extra log collecting and things.
Sounds like a beta to me.
That's how we do.
I like it. Well, sweet. Mike, that's about 30 minutes. I don't want to take too much of your time. I'm guessing that you're going to be talking a lot about Fusion in VMworld, this upcoming VMworld. Yeah.
We have our VMworld session. There's also going to be a section during the KubeCon talk, I believe, that we're doing over there as well. I think Miles, you're involved with some of that. So we'll be talking about some of the stuff there, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So myself and Steve Wong are doing a session at KubeCon EMEA, but KubeCon Online EMEA now.
Yeah.
In the next couple of weeks, there's a section on desktop hypervisors and what's coming and what's new for Kubernetes and developers as it pertains to the desktop hypervisor. So check that out and check out Mike's session at VMworld too.
Yeah, and the other one that's coming up too is I don't know if you guys heard about this, but we're doing a VMware CodeCon. So the VMware code team, I work with them pretty closely. We're putting on our own post-VMworld developer-only, developer-friendly type of conference where we're having a bunch of speakers come in and do hackathons, live demo, live talk. We're really trying to get it all to do the live thing rather than the simu-live type of thing.
Is that during VMworld?
It's just after. Like the first week of October. And we'll get the links out for there. But we're really excited about that. We've got some pretty cool partners and a lot of good content coming up.
Very nice. Yeah, I always love the hackathon at VMworld. That's one of the cooler events there. Good stuff.
Yeah, it's a real shame we couldn't all be together to do it, but this was our way of trying to keep that spirit alive.
Nice.
It's okay. We can all drink too much and eat way too much food on our own on a Zoom call.
Looking forward to that as well. Yeah. So Mike Roy, really appreciate you joining. For those that don't know Mike, he's on Twitter at Mike Roy Soft. I like that. That was pretty cheeky. And Miles Gray, thank you so much for joining us as well. I'm sure we'll see you again in the future. John, anything else before we let these guys go?
No, all this talk about getting the conference experience on me has me looking to see if I can order a jamon leg to my house. So
yeah, with some sangria to wash it down. I like it. All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Mike Roy and Miles Gray for joining us this week. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.